Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the wake of the civil rights movement, John Edgerton wrote a book titled The Americanization of Dixie, The Southernization of America. That book lays out his belief that the nation became stronger as a result of Southern influence and pointed to major civil rights leaders who had emerged from the South. But Edgerton also expressed some worries that the South would continue to export its racism. Well, now, almost 50 years later, two more Southern writers have their say. Former Charlotte Observer editor Fry Gilliard. Gilliard has teamed up with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and journalist in residence at the University of South Alabama, Cynthia Tucker, for a book that points to the racial backlash against President Obama, the rise of white nationalists, to the murder of George Floyd, and the insurrection at the Capitol as products of a Republican Southern strategy that began with Richard Nixon and runs through the Trump era. This hour, The Southernization of America, a story of democracy in the balance. That's the name of their book. Both authors join us now from Alabama. Thank you for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Fry, welcome back to Charlotte. I should say that right at the get-go here. Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. I'm really, good to hear your show again. I listened all the time when I lived in Charlotte. And so good to be part of it again. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Cynthia, this is kind of a follow-up, as I said, to John Edgerton's book of nearly 50 years ago. Would it be accurate to say that this also serves as a kind of checkup of sorts on America and that the South Edgerton wrote about in the 1970s?
Absolutely. We wanted to check in at the suggestion, actually, of Randall Williams, our editor at New South Books. He got in touch with Fry and asked Fry if he had about 20,000 words in him as a follow-up to Edgerton's book. And Fry said, I probably have a few more words than that. And I'm delighted to say that Fry asked me to join him in the project. And it came along at just the right time for me because I was trying to make sense of our current political moment. And there is so much about the South that has contributed to where we are as a nation. There are these parallel strains running through the South, one that is dark and malicious, and we all know about that strain, the South's violent and oppressive history of racism, but there is also a much more hopeful strain running through the South, the civil rights South, the South of those Southern governors who realized that segregation was not a good thing. And so just as the 2020 elections were going on, and there was so much going on in the country that was both hopeful and disturbing, this seemed a great moment to check in to see where we are. You know, Edgerton did believe that the civil rights movement was a great thing and hoped that the South would forever turn its back on racism. But he was also a bit of a pessimist. He worried that the South and the rest of the nation were not so much exchanging strengths as exchanging sins. So we check in and we find ourselves like Edgerton, seeing both good signs and worrisome signs of the trends that are currently occupying the country.
So obviously, your editor suggested that now would be the good time to do this. We had these political maneuvers surrounding the 2020 election, attempts at curtailing voting rights around much of the South, and to field MAGA candidates who deny the results of the previous election and who ascribe to a long list of conspiracy theories, some racial, some not. and who seem willing, more than willing in some cases, to jettison democracy for authoritarianism. But that's not just happening in the South, Fry. It's happening above the Mason-Dixon line and well to the west of the what we know now as the South. Is all of this due to sentiments that have crept out and continue to creep out of the South and infect the rest of the nation, or is that taking it a bit too far?
Well, I think I think you could take it too far. I mean, I think the South is a lens with which to view all of this. The South historically is the epicenter of racism in the country because it was the epicenter of slavery. So going all the way back to colonial times, that has been the great original sin of the South and therefore of the country, as that has, you know, sort of metastasized beyond our borders, which I think it continues to do. But, you know, you've always had writers like, and we quote a few of them, James Baldwin, Malcolm X, who talked about the indigenous racism of the North. So I don't want to put all of it on the South or over Southernize the perspective. And yet it's an interesting way to look at it because of that duality in the Southern character that Cynthia talked about. So, you know, look around in North Carolina. You have that division in North Carolina politics. You have that division in religion and what that means to different people in North Carolina. You have the Reverend William Barber, but you also have very conservative white evangelicals all talking from the same spiritual playbook. So we think the South is a useful way to look at it, and it's the vantage point that we happen to have because it's where we live, it's where we grew up.
There are a lot of racial overtones that are going on right now in the country and have for 600 years, I suppose. But Cynthia, there are other things coming into play here that have nothing, I don't think, to do with race, or maybe it does. You tell me, because you were trying to come to terms with what's happening politically in the nation right now and use this research for this book as a way to come to that understanding. How much of this is race-based and how much of it is many other things, economic, etc., coming into play here?
Well, I don't think that you can ever completely separate race from anything going on politically or culturally in the country. That is not to say that race is an overwhelming factor, but I think that race is a factor. You talked about the country's history, and Fry referred to the country's history. Remember that Thomas Jefferson, who wrote those wonderful words in our founding documents about freedom and liberty for all and equality for all. Thomas Jefferson was a Southerner, a Virginian, who was also a slaveholder. And so race was cemented into the foundations of the country. And I don't think we've ever been able to get away from that. Do economics play a part? Absolutely. But many members of the white working class blame people of color for their economic misfortune. So I also think that it is not an accident that Donald Trump picked up the playbook of George Wallace when he started his campaign. Donald Trump, by the way, came onto the political stage as a birther. The birther in chief, insisting that President Obama was not born in this country. When he announced his presidential campaign, how did he do it? He did it by denigrating Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers. So I think a lot of what we are seeing at the moment is bound up with race. Not all of it. There are other cultural changes that many people are upset about. fearful of, gay rights, the transgender rights movement, religious pluralism, a growing secularism in the country. But as I said earlier, I don't think you can completely erase race from any of the things that are going on at the moment.
When John Edgerton wrote his book, Fry, he was optimistic about the South's influence on the rest of the country and vice versa. But he was also skeptical. And at the time, you say, you thought he was too skeptical. This is back in the early 70s. And yet now you say you are more you are more skeptical even than he was. I guess, why were you more optimistic back then and less so today?
When John wrote his book, I looked around and I said, well, wait a minute. The civil rights movement, you know, had some profound effects. It ended segregation. It, you know, legal segregation. It secured voting rights for African-American people, particularly in the South where those rights were denied. And I thought it instituted at long last full democracy in the country, because it had not been that in our part of the country. And I looked around at the results of that, and I saw governors like Linwood Holton, a Republican in Virginia, or Reuben Askew, a Democrat in Florida, or, of course, Jimmy Carter in Georgia. And all of them were talking about putting racism behind us and moving forward into a day in which the South led the way for the rest of the country. It was inspirational talk to me, and I thought they were acting on it in good faith. And I was living in North Carolina, covering the community of Charlotte as it wrestled, I thought, with increasing good faith and at times even heroism in trying to understand and come to terms with the legacy of school segregation. So I looked around me at those things, and I thought, no, we can, we've learned some lessons here in the South, and maybe we can help impart those lessons to the rest of the country. But when Richard Nixon in 1968 and 72 talked about a Southern strategy, he didn't mean all of that. He meant appealing to that same politics of grievance that George Wallace had stoked in the 1960s when he ran for president. And it was racial for Wallace in, at the core of it, but Wallace talked more broadly about grievance, almost like he was teaching the nation to think in code. And I thought that's kind of what Nixon had in mind. And when Ronald Reagan got the presidential nomination for that same party in 1980, one of his first stops was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where there had been infamous civil rights murders. But he didn't talk about that. He talked about states' rights, which is a term that Southerners in the Civil War era used to mean the right to own slaves. And it's a term that George Wallace used, meaning the right to segregate. Surely Reagan knew that. Surely he was appealing to that grievance that had long lurked in the South. And so that appeal to the politics of grievance is the most disturbing thing to me, because I think it's continued to get stronger.
Yeah, I was going to say, it continues to this day. We have to take a break. Fry Gilliard, along with Cynthia Tucker, are both with us. They both are journalists. They both teach at the University of Southern Alabama, and they have both written a new book called The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy in the Balance. And that, I think, the subtitle is the most important part of all this, and we'll certainly get to that before the program is over at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Fry Gilliard, the former Observer editor and co-author of The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy in the Balance, along with Cynthia Tucker, who is the former editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the journalist in residence at the University of South Alabama, where Fry is also teaching at the moment. Following the civil rights movement, Cynthia, the South appeared to have made great strides in coming to terms with race. It became a kind of example. I mean, if the South can do this, can they can get over this, so can the rest of the country. But now we are witnessing, I think we could legitimately be called, significant backsliding. When it comes to the South or the nation at large, are we going to wake up one day 50 years from now, 100 years from now, next week, and realize that race is our Achilles heel?
I fear so, Mike. I really do. And I am old enough that I had, for much of my life, believed in a phrase that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King adapted. He would often say that the moral arc of the universe bends long, but it bends toward justice. And I believe that because I grew up as the civil rights movement was already producing changes throughout the South. And my parents understood that their children would have many more opportunities than they did. And let me point out that the South is much better off economically now than it was during Jim Crow. Many companies, multinational companies, big national companies, after Jim Crow was ended, thought, okay, it is now acceptable for us to plant a flag in the Deep South. And so there were all of these Southern cities that grew more prosperous: Atlanta, Charlotte, Nashville, and smaller cities as well. And so I really believed that, and many of us believed, that we were inexorably moving in the right direction and would continue to do so. And then the first Black president was elected. And many of us thought, again, that not only was this obviously a historic watershed movement for the country, but again, we would keep moving in the right direction. But something else happened instead. I was in Washington, D.C. at the time as a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, watching a movement that called itself the Tea Party rise to prominence. And while they claimed that they were concerned about government spending, I went to many of their rallies and I saw the awful racist posters that they held aloft. President Obama's face imposed on a gorilla or a witch doctor. And so this was not about opposition to President Obama's policies, which would have been legitimate, of course, in a democracy. This was about the fear and resentment of a Black man as president. And I believe that that led directly to the election of Donald Trump.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I want to add one little thing to that, too. On the theory that that history echoes, as William Faulkner said, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. If you look back to the days of Reconstruction in the South, the idea took root, took hold back in those days that African-American progress was a measure of loss by white Americans. It was what Black people gained was what white people were losing. I mean, that idea became kind of the mantra almost of the so-called redeemers, the white people who wanted to reestablish white supremacy. And so they stripped African Americans of the right to vote and established Jim Crow laws and all of that kind of stuff. So all of that goes back into time. They're analogs for the fear that the young man, the shooter in Buffalo, was talking about when he talked about replacement theory, that if African-American people make progress, it's always at the expense of white people. And it just isn't true. And we have to say that. We live in what's inevitably a multiracial, multicultural country that is not going to change. It's only going to become more so. And so, you know, we can try to move forward with understanding and goodwill and dialogue and honest disagreement and respectful disagreement when necessary, you know, or we can nurse our grievances and inflate them, and it's not going to be a very good place to live if we continue to do that.
Let me bring this home to Charlotte for just a moment and also bring in some of the things you've been talking about, because you were working, Fry, at the Charlotte Observer during the years that Charlotte was dealing with integration. You're all too familiar with, and I don't know whether this came before you, but you're certainly familiar with the fact that business leaders here in this city got together and they decided that integration was good for business, and by God, it was going to happen. And there wasn't, we weren't going to be Selma in Charlotte. You were also here to watch the rocky start of integration of our school system, which turned out to be more than a success. We became the poster child for how to do it right around the country. Test scores rose here. All boats were rising, and suddenly the courts decided that that wasn't necessary to do anymore. And just like that, we resegregated the schools, not by order, just by natural selection and white flight. So what does that say about Charlotteans, about Southerners, about America? That we know we can do it, we have proof that we did it, that it was good for everybody, but we don't want it.
Yeah, it was very disheartening. I was still here when that happened. And, you know, Charlotte is not alone in that storyline. Charlotte is kind of a bellwether city. I mean, because it was so successful. I mean, it was never perfect, but it was so successful, and people were trying to make it better. And then we, and I say we because I was still here at the time. Then, like you said, Mike, we decided no, we don't want that. And it's you know, it's very disheartening, but I think it foreshadowed what soon began to happen in the rest of the country. And I just think, you know, that's one of the reasons we wrote the book is partly as a warning. And yet we also wanted to say that we still see the same, you know, glimmers of hope in various places that we saw in Charlotte in the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. You know, you see in Georgia, the election of the first African-American and the first Jewish senator in that state's history. And, you know, Raphael Warnock, the first black senator, in his maiden speech said, you know, I now hold the seat that Herman Talmadge, an arch segregationist, once held. And he said, that's why I love America. So that isn't dead, but it's our hope, we think. And that kind of spirit, that kind of a view of what it means, what America can be and what it must be.
But when we talk about race, the South, with some justification, gets a bad name because of slavery, etc. But I'm just curious, Cynthia, whether you think we deserve that much blame, because the end of busing to achieve integration in Charlotte was the result of newcomers to Charlotte suing and winning that lawsuit because they wanted their child in a particular school. They weren't from here. Charlotte has changed substantially since the civil rights era. Atlanta has changed substantially. And that change comes from an influx of people coming here from elsewhere. So are we really bellwethers for Southern racial sentiment? Are we Southern anymore?
Well, one of the arguments that Edgerton was already making was that the South was becoming less isolated from the rest of the nation. It had been isolated for generations since the Civil War, but was becoming less so by the time Edgerton published his book in 1974. that's even more true now, not just television and interstate highways, but people travel much more now. There's the internet. The South is much less isolated as a region. It's also true, Mike, as you said, that the South has changed a lot and was changing a lot even before we began to see a migration into our cities, especially of people from other regions of the country. Charlotte, as you say, has changed. Nashville has changed. Atlanta has changed tremendously. But it's also true, unfortunately, that if you look at voting patterns, you will see that Democrats have been losing the white Southern vote since the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were passed in the mid-60s. So there is still something about the South where it is easy here to cultivate, to prey on, excuse me, fear and resentment of the other. But the flip side is that the South also has many wonderful examples. And the late, great John Lewis believed that there was more hope for change in the South than anywhere else.
And certainly at the beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement, even at the end of the Civil Rights Movement, people in the South were probably held more racist attitudes than they do today, it seems to me, because times have changed, hopefully, a little bit. LBJ rightfully predicted that with the Civil Rights Act, the Democrats would lose the South for a very, very, very long time, and that's still proving to be the case. And then along comes Richard Nixon and the so-called Southern strategy that you've already referred to. Remind us, Cynthia, what that was, that strategy.
Well, Richard Nixon watched George Wallace running for president in 1968. And he saw that Wallace drew enthusiastic crowds, not just in the South, but in parts of the Northeast and Midwest as well. And Nixon understood that he could borrow from that playbook. And Nixon had advisors who helped him with that. One was a young man named Lee Atwater, who helped to hone the Southern strategy. So what Nixon understood was that he could implicitly, if not explicitly, appeal to fear, white resentment, white grievance, without using the N-word, obviously, without talking about race explicitly. Nixon talked about law and order. This was a time when there was a lot of unrest in poor Black neighborhoods in big cities. There was a lot of civil unrest. So Nixon talked about law and order, and that was code for, I'm going to put these Black people back in their place. And Republicans, by the way, have used some form of the Southern strategy ever since.
Yeah, George Wallace was sometimes overt in his racism, sometimes not so. He said segregation now, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. That's pretty clear right there. But then he did learn how to use what you've referred to as code words so that he didn't have to talk directly about race. And that is something, Fry, that Donald Trump either observed or just knew intuitively how to exploit. Wallace seemed transparent in terms of what he stood for, but a lot of people spent years scratching their heads trying to figure out exactly what Trump, what his appeal was. If politicians can use code words and they can successfully get people to hear that message, why can't we all hear that message? Why do some of us miss that message?
Well, it seems to me that the politics of grievance that Wallace really worked to develop was something that was just at the very core and cornerstone of Trump's appeal. And I'm not sure why people missed it, because it seemed pretty obvious to me, that, you know, you can stir the anger and the worst within people pretty easily sometimes. And it's there, you know, there are people who look around them and things bother them. And sometimes they're looking for scapegoats or whatever it may be. Sometimes they just need to feel angry. And so politicians can tap into that quite cynically and effectively, I think. And Wallace showed us that was possible. But I also look around and I see people trying to tap into what former Republican strategist Steve Schmidt, who helped manage John McCain's campaign, what Schmidt calls the coalition of decency. And in the South, I think that's never going to be a plurality of white Southerners, or majority of white Southerners. But if there's a substantial minority of white Southerners who make common cause with people with whom they genuinely have common cause, people of color, to try to create a society where we understand and respect each other, you know, that's always been the frontier of civilization. But we see that happening sometimes in the South. In Georgia in 2020, North Carolina has a history of that with politicians like Jim Hunt, like Roy Cooper. We've seen it in Virginia. So, there are still glimmers of that. Even George Wallace, after he was shot and was in pain and said publicly that he began to identify with the pain of other people, including pain that he had caused, ran for governor the last time in a way that he won a majority of the black vote in Alabama and appointed more African Americans to state government than any governor ever had. So, I mean, things happen that surprise us, that are possible. And one of the things we're trying to do with this book is to say, let's draw on that legacy as well.
I don't have a lot of time here, but you write in your book, Cynthia, about NBC News, longtime NBC News correspondent Douglas Kuiker, who was watching a Midwest crowd watch George Wallace on the stump back in the 60s. And he came to this epiphany that everybody watching that, they were all Southern. This was in the Midwest. But he said they were all Southern. The whole United States is Southern. And yet the South gets this rap for being racist. Is that fair? I have 10 seconds.
Mike, it probably isn't. Kuiker was not a Southerner, but we hadn't seen that as explicitly in other parts as we have here in the South.
And let me stop there. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Fry Gelliard and Cynthia Tucker. Fry used to be at the Charlotte Observer. Cynthia used to be at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. They're both journalists. They're both teaching at the University of Southern Alabama, and they have both written a book called The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy in the Balance. And Cynthia, you wanted to follow up on something we were talking about in the last segment, about why people can hear these code words while others cannot.
Well, one of the reasons I think is because, first of all, having grown up Black in America, I may have better instincts and for this sort of language. But let me also say that I remember that after Obama was elected, there were many pundits who declared that we were now in a post-racial America. People wanted very much to believe that we were beyond the place where race mattered in America. But let me say that our current landscape makes it so clear that we're not. We just had another horrible racial massacre in Buffalo, New York, at a grocery store, where an 18-year-old white guy went in tactical gear and killed at least 10 people. The vast majority of them Black. He apparently had immersed himself in this nonsense about replacement theory. Fry spoke of this earlier, where so many whites believe that if Black folks gain, if Asian Americans gain, if Muslim Americans gain, then whites lose. That is simply not the case. If you look at the 1980s and the 1990s in America, when we were moving in the right direction, everybody gained. And that is something I hope people will focus on.
And Connie, one of our listeners, emails, as a person who grew up in the lily white suburb up north, I can tell you that although the expression is less extreme and was never institutionalized as it was in the South, racism against Black people exists in the North. Indeed, I think it is likely one reason that the North and the Republican Party of the 19th century tolerated the establishment of Jim Crow after Reconstruction. In the preface to your book, you quote John Edgerton's book, The Southernization of America, or The Americanization of Dixie, as saying, "The South and the nation are exchanging sins, the dominant trends of which are deep divisions along race and class lines, an obsession with growth and acquisition and consumption, a headlong rush to the cities and suburbs, diminution of waste of natural resources, institutional malfunctioning, abuse of political and economic power, increasing depersonalization, and a steady erosion of a sense of place, of community, of belonging." Fry, he could have written those words today.
Absolutely. And I was listening to you reading John's words, and I was thinking about what you were saying earlier about as Charlotte grew in the 1980s and 1990s at such a rapid rate, it was people not from Charlotte originally who wanted to move away from our achievements in integrated schools. And I was thinking part of that was the loss of a sense of community, of civic mindedness and community cohesion, or at least a decline in that sense, when Charlotte simply got bigger. So we've seen that, that's been one of the byproducts, and it doesn't get any easier, I guess, to maintain that sense of community and place that Edgerton thought was a good thing if you could, rein in the racism that sometimes went with that sense of isolation in the South. So, this is not easy stuff. I mean, you look anywhere in the world, in the frontier of civilization, sort of the spiritual frontier of civilization in a way, is people who are not exactly alike learning to live together peacefully and respectfully. It's hard everywhere you look. But we have in this country, guiding philosophies, founding philosophies that have helped us, that can help us. And we have experience, historical experience, about how things get better when we try to live in a democratic country with a civil exchange of views. I mean, it's the only thing that really makes any sense.
Following the election of Barack Obama, Cynthia, you mentioned this, people thought we were in a post-racial society. Boy, were they wrong. It created this backlash that led to the election of Donald Trump and a rise of other populist candidates who covertly or openly embrace white nationalist principles. Is it that? Was it a reaction to the race of the previous president, Obama? Or was it just the fact that it coincided with the disappearance of the middle class, the realization that your children may not do as well as you have done, and a feeling of a loss of power and control and a loss of connection to what has been traditionally thought of as the American dream?
I don't have any doubt that economics played a significant role in the election of Donald Trump and what came afterwards. We're seeing the rise of autocratic instincts in Western democracies around the globe. And social scientists tell us that income inequality has a lot to do with that. My concern, again, is that so many people who feel that they have gotten the short end of the stick, so many whites who believe they've gotten the short end of the stick, blame the wrong people for that. They blame immigrants of color. If in the United States, they blame immigrants of color, Black Americans, Native Americans. Let me say that one of the worst things that I see on the landscape at the moment is the rise of autocratic instincts.
Yes.
I don't think many Americans are aware that our democracy is in trouble. People are concerned about their day-to-day lives, inflation, the price of gasoline. I understand all that. But what we have in the U.S. that has been a great democratic experiment could be lost if people don't take this seriously. People need to vote. People need to turn away from the conspiratorial theories. People need to vote in even small elections, school board elections. Don't let the book banners take over. Don't let the people who keep talking about critical race theory, when they really mean actual American history, don't let them take over. So I hope people will understand that democracy really is in the balance and take that seriously.
This appeal toward grievance, using a lot of falsehoods just name calling, et cetera, to demonize the other side and dehumanize the other side and say that you're the best and we're the salvation of it all, has led to an entire political party being hijacked by people who would easily throw over democracy for their own power. And if people don't believe that, all they have to look at is the turning back of voting rights, the attempts to turn back those voting rights, the putting in place, the attempts to put in place people who don't subscribe to the fact that the last election was legitimate and would absolutely overturn any election that didn't come down in their favor, because obviously if it wasn't in their favor, it would be illegitimate. This plays to the subtitle of your book, A Story of Democracy in the Balance. I'm just curious where you think people, average people, come down on this. Are they thinking about it? Do they believe it? Place our democracy on the spectrum. Where are we in terms of getting ready to lose it? Who would like to answer that?
If you look around, what are the latest polls say about the number of people who identify as Republicans who believe that the election was stolen? I mean, it's a huge percentage. And, you know, if people are told that again and again and again, and if the message has come down from high places that truth is what you want it to be, then that's an insidious thing that's out there in Alabama, where Cynthia and I both live. A conservative Republican governor who nevertheless was not, we didn't think, a hard right Republican governor is now running ads that say we all know the election was stolen. It wasn't. That's a fundamentally undemocratic thing.
This goes beyond race. When you reach that point where truth is fungible and where you can demonize the other side, say that they are child pederasts or worse, How do you run a country? How can you have a democracy, a functioning democracy, Cynthia? Can you, or is it over?
I worry a lot. I worry a lot based on just what you just said, that if people abandon facts, if they abandon reality, it's going to be very difficult to keep a democracy. You know, the founding fathers knew that a democratic government depended on having a well-informed citizenry. If a significant portion of us have thrown facts away, I don't know how you govern. And in that context, I need to mention the conservative Christian church, which I think has done far too much in terms of abandoning reality for something else. This is not all conservative Christians by any means, but there are many conservative Christian churches out there where the pastors and the deacons are saying that, you know, if Democrats get elected, if liberals are in control, then Christianity will be eradicated. Then Bibles will be burned. That is simply not true. And so I am afraid that in a country where people have tossed away reality, it will be impossible to have a democratic government.
One of our listeners has emailed, where I see the Southernization of the U.S. impacting our politics is in the dominance of fundamentalism in Southern culture. In order to be a good fundamentalist, you are required to believe some things despite strong evidence to the contrary. Creationism versus evolution, young Earth versus Big Bang, etc. It kind of seems like a good practice for, say, believing that the 2020 election was fraudulent despite strong evidence to the contrary. Not to mention the 5 years of Donald Trump spouting every word out of his mouth was a lie, including the words and the. We have reached a place where the divide is deep and wide in this country. And Fry, you have said we have to decide if this wants to be a good place to live, if we're at each other's throats, if we're trying to dominate one another, if we're deliberately and willfully misunderstanding one another, if we're being mean to each other. We have it within our power to make America a crappy place to live. But the stakes are Go ahead.
Absolutely, Mike. That's perfectly said.
Well, you said it. But the stakes.
Well, you said it better. Oh, there you go.
But the stakes seem so high as to be insurmountable. What's your take on that?
You know, in my worst days, I fear that the stakes are so high as to be insurmountable. But I also look at glimmers of hope here and there, and I think we have to keep trying. We have to bear witness. We have to vote. We have to do all of those things, and then we have to just hope that it's enough. I mean, the 2020 election did repudiate Donald Trump, so.
You said that your book is part hope and part warning, but in your book, you used the phrase that Cynthia brought up a few minutes ago, originally put forth by Dr. Martin Luther King, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But you say we, meaning the two of you, are not sure if we should believe him. Wow. Haven't we moved toward social justice? Aren't we continuing to do that? Is this anything more than two steps forward, one step back?
Well, we don't know. The nation has made tremendous progress over its history, over the centuries of its history. We have continued to move forward. Sometimes it's been two steps forward and three steps back, but we've continued to move forward. But we are at an inflection point. And this is what I'd say about what Dr. King said. The moral arc of the universe bends long, but it also needs our help. We need to keep pushing that moral arc toward justice.
I have 30 seconds, Fry. You make a strong case, but you lay out this warning to us all. The question is, are you spitting into the wind? Are people who need to see this the people who are going to read this book?
Well, that's the worry, Mike. You know, we may be preaching to the choir, not only in writing the book, but in the people that, you know, who come out to hear us talk about it, which we'll be doing at Park Road Books on Wednesday. But, we just have to keep trying, and we're certainly willing to share our views with anybody and hear what they have to say in return.
Fry Gillier gets the last word. Former editor of the Charlotte Observer, Cynthia Tucker, with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Together, they have written The Southernization of America, A Story of Democracy in the Balance. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.